This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Olli Rehn, who is the Vice President of the European Commission and Commissioner for Economic and Monetary Affairs. Olli, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be here.
Set the stage for us. When the financial crisis of 2008 hit, how did Europe's situation differ from that of the United States?
In the beginning, many in Europe thought that this is a crisis only in the United States. But to my mind, it was obvious that the financial crisis, which started as a crisis of American financial capitalism in the Wall Street, turned into a global financial crisis and economic recession, which hit Europe very bad also in 2008 and 2009. Then Europe engaged together with its international partners into massive monetary and fiscal stimulus, which helped to overcome that period of crisis. But since 2010, we have suffered from the next stage or second stage of the crisis, which has been a banking and debt crisis in Europe.
And when the crisis hit, Europe was still in the process of building its institutions. So if we look at the United States, going back to our founding, Alexander Hamilton put in place some institutions. For example, I believe the national government absorbed the state debts.
That's right.
And it wasn't until more than 100 years later that that we established a Federal Reserve Bank. But Europe was then still a work in progress.
Very much so. Very much so. And in fact, still we are. But we have done a lot since the beginning of the crisis to reinforce our institutions and to reform and reinforce our economic governance in particular. What I mean is that when the Economic and Monetary Union was originally constructed some 20 years ago, then the monetary pillar was strong. There was a strong monetary union, but the economic pillar was actually rather weak, almost non-existent. And what we have now been forced to do during the crisis has triggered movement towards reinforcement of this economic pillar by reinforcing economic policy coordination, creating a European stability mechanism, and also to build a banking union, which is currently a work in progress.
Your training is as a political economist.
Correct.
Basically.
Correct.
And political economy is different than being a traditional, just an economist, or being just a political scientist. Talk a little about your training and help us understand how a political economy perspective helps one understand what's going on in Europe.
I studied originally economics and political science. I did my master's degree on these subjects. But then when I became more interested in European integration, I realized that, in fact, the study of international political economy is a rather meaningful device to analyze and understand Europe's evolution and European political and economic integration. It focuses essentially on the interaction between economics and politics, which in the European context is a very relevant way of looking at things and is a very, say, meaningful worldview of understanding Europe. And the difference between economics and political economy in this sense could be described so that economics aims at first best solutions from the point of view of economic and social welfare, while political economy brings politics and institutions into the equation. And in some ways, I feel that often the US-trained economists and economics is a very American science, tend to look at Europe from the point of view of this, say, economics first best solutions, but they don't take into account the political constraints, which often lead, for better or worse, lead the Europeans to look for second best solutions, which are taken and decided in the context of quite significant political and institutional constraints.
And so this is an important case of theory and practice. So if you have pure theory and economic models that point in one direction, when they guide a policy, you enter a different world because you have to adjust to the realities.
That's right, and I can give you a very concrete example from the real world of economic policy making of the European Union. That's from spring 2010, when we had the Greek crisis on, and we had first agreed on a Greek loan facility to support Greece, and then a week later we agreed, after a very difficult political process, we agreed on the creation of the European Financial Stability Mechanism and Facility, which are called the EFSM and EFSF in the European jargon. And the difficulty then was that if you looked for, or the challenge was that if you looked for a first best solution, you would have gone to a direction of, say, Alexander Hamilton and introduced joint and several guarantees to this stability mechanism. However, the 17 member states of the euro area were very divided on this. Some wanted joint and several guarantees. Some other member states wanted only what is called pro rata, or each and every member state guarantees only its own share of the facility, which makes it clearly weaker in terms of its lending capacity and in terms of its say real effectiveness and efficiency. So if we had only striven for the first best solution, we would have had no decision. So instead, in those negotiations, we had to opt for the second best solution, which was clearly not optimal, but nevertheless helped to overcome the worst period of crisis by the creation of this European Financial Stability Facility, which has been used in parallel with the IMF funding to support Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and more lately Greece, and also Cyprus.
Now there has been a raucous debate in the United States about what Europe is doing, and criticism of how it's doing things wrong, and how theory points in the direction of easy solutions. I think here of Paul Krugman of the New York Times. And from a European perspective, is part of the agenda there in those commentaries really about the American debate and the need for stimulus here, and therefore leads to a kind of facile understanding of the kind of constraints that we're talking about now?
I think there are two points here which are relevant. First, I have a feeling that some of the columnists and pundits in the US, whether economists or policy entrepreneurs, tend to target their messages to the US political debate or US economic policy debate while they are actually talking about Europe and using Europe as a, say, political device in the US debate. I'm not sure if that's the most productive way of leading a substantive and well-informed discussion. The other dimension is then that often columnists, pundits, and policy entrepreneurs do not take into account the complex reality of European policy making and institutional structure. For instance, when we talk about crisis management in Europe, when we didn't have institutions ready for that purpose, like the European Stability Mechanism, we had to build that from the scratch, and it meant that each and every member state has a veto right. So we have often situations where we have 17 red lines from the member states, then one from the European Central Bank, 19th from the International Monetary Fund, and then the Commission is trying to broker a deal between these different tendencies, different vectors, and we have to lean on unanimity, which is usually leading to, say, suboptimal, optimal, or second best solutions. Of course, that's the reason why we want to reinforce the institutional structure and have a more effective decision making in Europe, which normally in the European Union works by qualified majority of the member states and a simple majority of the European Parliament, which is called the community method, which makes the European Union tick, work, and deliver.
I'm an international relations specialist, and so what you're describing is a system in which anarchy, international anarchy, where each state is after its own self-interest, that part of the task of what's going on in Europe is to be a slow process, an evolving process of moving from a classical international system to one of union, basically, with a careful and deliberate building of institutions, but where politics is at play in implementing what might be theoretical truths. Is that fair?
I think it's a fair description. And in fact, you put this discussion of the current contemporary debate on Europe's different ways forward into a continuum of theoretical discussion in international relations. And normally, if you talk with, say, European officials, their mindset is quite strongly influenced by, I would say, the institutionalist approach of international relations, where building common institutions is reinforcing common security and providing a platform for better economic policy coordination or for better work towards peace and stability. And you can trace this at least from the League of Nations, the United Nations, and the European Union is of the same genre than these institutions, although clearly stronger in terms of its decision making, which is based on qualified majority. And here there is one further aspect which is quite important. You have in the, say, normal politics and policy making of the European Union, we work on the basis of the community method, which provides with qualified majority voting, is more effective, and brings results in terms of budgetary or legislative decisions. On the other hand, on constitutional matters, like the creation of the European Stability Mechanism, or any treaty change, you work on the basis of unanimity, because the member states want to keep the right to decide on the competences of the Union in their own hands. So during the crisis, in some areas we could work with the community method, which is more effective, but in some of the critical areas, as I said, we had to build institutions from the scratch, and these were constitutional decisions based on unanimity and done with an intergovernmental method.
Now, the community method is a majority vote, or
It is, yes. It's usually we distinct, we make a distinction between two methods, the community method and the intergovernmental method. And the community method is based on basically three elements: the Commission's right of initiative and responsibility of implementation of the decisions, qualified majority in the, which means about 70% majority of the votes in the council among the member states, and then a normal majority or simple majority in the European Parliament. So the normal way of legislating in the European Union is that the Commission makes a legislative proposal, for instance, on the single resolution mechanism for euro area banks, quite a recent proposal. And then you need a qualified majority in the Council and in parallel a majority in the European Parliament. And this negotiate a little bit like Senate and the House of Representatives in the US at Capitol Hill. So that's the, say, normal way of taking decisions. And then you have the intergovernmental method, which is often more prevalent in foreign policy and constitutional matters in the European Union.
Mm-hmm. So on the constitutional issues, you're really limited in what you can achieve, basically, because there you have to have unanimity.
That's correct, and that's understandable in many ways, especially if you can plan medium to long term. But in the crisis context, if you are bound to work within those constraints, you have 20 red lines, and it's very difficult to find common territory where you can find a first best decision, even a second best decision.
So you're describing, the truism is that a crisis can be a good thing because things can happen. But for you, there are two aspects of a crisis, you being the European Union. One is the crisis may be so bad that you have to do something right away. So you might get a short-term stimulus, basically, as you described.
That's right.
After the two. But the other part of a crisis for you is to plan and think through the building of new institutions, which the situation says, well, we've got to have this. But there you basically have to try to find unanimity about what is a central, what is clearly a European institution that is needed for this kind of crisis in the future.
Harry, you are becoming a specialist on European institutions. That's a very, very accurate and correct description of it. And I would paraphrase it so that we have, during this past years of crisis, we have had to engage ourselves both into firefighting of the current crisis to avoid that the bushfires in some parts of Europe turn into a complete forest fire, destroying the Eurozone. And at the same time, in parallel, we have had to rebuild the architecture of the economic and monetary union, especially by bringing life to the E, which is the economic pillar of the economic and monetary union. And we have worked on this in parallel. And I understand that when rebuilding architecture, you need to take constitutional decisions. You have to think issues very carefully, and you need very broad, even unanimity for these decisions. But if you have to apply this unanimity method in crisis management, it is hopelessly slow and ineffective. And that's why we have tried to both reinforce the architecture through the European Stability Mechanism, for instance, so that we are better in this crisis management, firefighting dimension of our challenge.
Now, in the traditional view of international power, the most powerful countries have a greater say because they're acting on their own and they have the resources and they're bringing to the table a national culture and both economic and military power. So as you're moving away from that system, as you're building these institutions, you have to have your ears tuned to the balance of power, basically, among the states. And it would seem that in your role at the commission, political education becomes very important because you've got to persuade and convince when there isn't enough power in the EU itself, but power resides in particular states.
That's right. And in fact, a big part of my work is to work with the member state governments, obviously, not only in the formal settings of the Eurogroup, which gathers the 17, soon 18 finance ministers of the Eurozone, but also bilaterally and directly with the finance ministers, as well as often with the central bankers in Europe, including, of course, the European Central Bank, which is a key player of European economic and monetary policy making. So I cannot only rest on my laurels in Brussels. I have to go to Berlin, to Paris, Rome, Helsinki, Athens, Madrid, and indeed have a direct contact. I believe that this work can only be done in the spirit of partnership with the member states, who need to have ownership both on their own policies, on economic policies, as well as on the economic policy of the Eurozone in its entirety.
Now all political leaders in national settings have their eye on the next election. And once they're elected, they may have to build a coalition. So that's their reality on one hand. And on the other hand, your tool is one of persuasion and argument. And what you have going for you in the background is your assumption that they believe in the union, that they are committed to the European Union. And so is that the navigation that you have to do, respectful of their political situation on the one hand, but pulling them along into the future because of their commitment to the European Union?
Yes, you have to definitely, in my position, I have to understand the domestic political context of basically each and every member state of the European Union. And then I need to persuade and support the member state governments in their efforts of ensuring sustainable public finances and pursuing growth-enhancing economic reforms. In addition to this, we have over the past 3 years reformed economic governance in the European Union, especially the Eurozone economic governance. And one critical aspect there is that we now have an effective enforcement mechanism, which also can be called, without any Orwellian newspeak, we can call it a sanctions regime, which means that if a member state is not respecting its commitments, especially in fiscal policy, then it is possible to propose and then council decide on financial sanctions against that member state. I'm not a big fan of sanctions. I believe rather in partnership and persuasion. But it is also a fact that this sanction regime is giving spine to policymaking in the member states. And we see now results in a sense that fiscal deficits have come down in Europe from almost 7% some years ago to the current 3%, and they are further declining. I could give you an example from the from a one member state where this has been quite relevant over the past years, Belgium. Belgium had no government for almost 2 years, no politically mandated government for almost 2 years. In December 2011, when this new system of economic governance entered into force, Belgium would have faced sanctions of about slightly less than 1 billion euros unless it started restructuring its budget to ensure the sustainability of public finances. So Belgium had to choose, and the Belgian political leaders had to choose whether to save through expenditure cuts and tax increases around 1 billion euros, or whether to, say, contribute 1 billion euros to the EU as a financial sanction. So very wisely, they chose rather to consolidate. They created a budget coalition of six parties in December 2011, January 2012. And then that became the government of Prime Minister Elia Di Rupo, which is still governing Belgium and is likely to govern Belgium until the next elections, which will take place in the summer of 2014.
So in other words, it's not just carrots. There's also a stick, which you want to use carefully, because you can then achieve the result you want by holding back all of its.
That's right.
But, yeah.
I would say that it's better to talk about carrots, but it's quite useful also to have a stick to carry with you.
Now, I want to understand even better your perspective, and as I heard you give several talks on the campus, I had the sense that in this environment, when you look at what you can do, what the Commission can do to move this process forward, that several issues came to mind, and I want to talk about them. One is timing, basically. You have to be attuned to when it's appropriate to move on something. And here there is both a short-term perspective and a long-term perspective. Talk about that. Is that correct?
It is correct, and there are many aspects in this. If you take the example of rebuilding the economic and monetary union, or rebuilding the architecture of the Eurozone governance, there we have certain issues which we have already done, in fact, which we could do in the frame of the current treaty on European Union without having to change the treaty, which requires unanimity and often a very heavy ratification process in the member states, including referenda in some member states. So now we have exhausted the room of maneuver within the treaty as regards economic and fiscal integration. And the next steps, for instance, any kind of further mutualization of economic risk would require treaty changes, and thus they are necessarily medium to long-term issues. Also, the banking union is a good example. In our view, and our lawyers have studied this very carefully, in our view, we can build both a single supervisory mechanism for euro area banks and a single resolution mechanism with a resolution, common resolution fund within the frame of the current treaty framework. So this we want to conclude before the end of the current parliament, which is basically by the end of March next year, 2014. Then there will be other issues, and I trust that the political debate in the election campaign of the European Parliament and the following months when the new commission will be formed will be used for the purposes of how to take further steps in improving the economic governance and economic performance of the European Union.
The second element that struck me was the power, which we actually have talked about a little, the distribution of power. But here, let's link that to timing. So in a way, if the balance of power institutionally and among the nation states is not ripe yet to achieve, then you have to be responsive to that, and your solution then looks more like a long-term effort.
Yes, and I think when you talk about the balance of power, which I understand is very typical of the international relations terminology, in the European Union, of course, power politics play a role, but the whole idea of the European Union is to pool sovereignties and use it through the European institutions for the common good of Europe. And that's why we, in fact, we want to replace the balance of power by, say, more synthetic integration of European peoples and states, citizens. And this is what the European integration process is pretty much about. And the coming period of elections and then elections of the European Parliament and then the formation of the next commission and other key decisions, also the next commission's policy program will be a key moment of thinking how we next take how we take the next steps to reinforce the European Union in this context. And I believe that the issue of democratic legitimacy is one of the key matters here, especially in economic governance, where we have reinforced policy coordination and created the enforcement mechanism. There, the member states have supported these institutional reforms by unanimity, and there has been an overwhelming majority in the European Parliament to support this. That's fine, but when the Commission then, which has the right and responsibility to give policy advice to member states, when we do our job, then the very same leaders often are criticizing us for doing the job that they have tasked us to do, in fact. So our task is basically to try to ensure that the member states practice what they preach in terms of their European commitments in economic and fiscal policy. But that's not always very well received. Therefore, we have to have a profound debate on democratic legitimacy, on political accountability in Europe. And that's going to be the music for the next years, I believe.
Now, politicians in general, let's call them political leaders in general, have, and this is universal, we're not talking about Europe, have a tendency to say one thing on the campaign trail and another when they're actually governing, even in a system like ours, the U.S. So this complexity of this system creates another shield for them, basically, because it's not just promising things on the campaign trail and then doing it nationally, but then going to the EU councils and maybe supporting something which you are tasked with implementing, but then changing their mind or not being as honest about the difference between what they said and what they've done.
In my view, democracy is a very fundamental principle of the European Union, and elections campaigns are obviously a natural and essential element of democracy in action. So we have learned to live with that, and we can live with that. At the same time, the European Union is trying to support the member states to conduct such kind of economic policies that will support sustainable growth and job creation, which sometimes creates a tension between, say, political pledges done during the electoral campaign and the reality of economic policy making. But I think we have proven that we are able to live with this and even overcome this challenge by taking decisions together in the European Union while respecting the democratic principles and electoral results.
The third element that came out in your talks that you've given on the Berkeley campus in the last is the idea of sequencing of priorities. So you know what the crisis taught you, the financial crisis, and what needed to be done. And you outlined three major goals. And you've talked about some of them, but let's just briefly explicate them. So the need for a banking union, the need for sustainability of public finances, and then finally structural reforms. So let's briefly look at those. The banking union means a European Fed-like FDIC institution building, so that you would have the power European-wide to respond to a future crisis. Talk a little about that first.
Take this first pillar. This is a core part of the reform of European institutions. And you may ask why we do this. We do it not to bail out bankers, but to create solid foundations for sustainable growth and job creation, because we need the credit to flow, and we need investment for that. And that's why we are now completing the financial repair and building the banking union. This means basically that we are now doing what the US did already in the 1930s when the Fed took the role of the lender of last resort during the Great Depression, and when the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was created. They are not exactly identical to what we are now building, but in many ways you can compare the European effort today with the US effort during the Great Depression in the early 1930s. And we are now making good progress in this so that we have already the law in force concerning the single supervisory mechanism, which will cover around 130 big banks and 85% of the assets in the Eurozone economy. The next step will be the single resolution mechanism and a common resolution fund, and we will have a political agreement on this by the end of this year. So by the end of next year, 2014, by early 2015, we should have these critical elements of the banking union in place and in action.
And by resolution, you mean resolving the balance sheets of the banks, cleaning up the mess.
You can say that we create a framework to clean up the mess in the banks in order to ensure a healthy and resilient banking sector, if needed through restructuring, winding down, recapitalization. But you need clear rules for this, and now we are making these rules and the framework.
The second was the sustainability of public finances. And so that is the state budgets, the nation state budgets within the European Union cleaning up their balance sheets.
I would say that it is a matter of ensuring the structural sustainability of public finances over the medium term. In other words, we faced a debt crisis in 2009-2010 in Europe following the large and unsustainable macroeconomic imbalances in big parts of Europe, from Spain to Greece and Ireland to Portugal. This work is now being done both in the field of, say, private sector and public sector. In the private sector, that relates to the banking union, which we discussed already, because the issue of private debt is at least as problematic as public debt in Europe. Concerning public debt, the level of public debt is now above 90% in Europe. It has risen from 60% to 90% during the crisis. during the financial crisis and economic recession. And we have, through the reform and reinforcement of economic governance, and thanks to the enhanced credibility of euro area member states, public finances and fiscal policies, been able to reduce the deficits substantially. So it is not sudden, heavy-handed consolidation, but rather we aim at consistent and gradual consolidation of public finances, where the focus is rather on the medium term. But in order to succeed in the medium term, you also have to take action in the short term.
And then finally, your goal with regard to what you call structural reforms. And here we get into a tricky area. Talk a little about that. In other words, what kind of reforms do these individual states have to make to ensure the sustainability of economic growth?
These focus both on what I would call structural competitiveness related to education, innovation, enhancing of productivity, and to cost competitiveness, where we are talking about unit labor costs. Both are important, and it depends always on the specific situation of each and every member state. What is our recommendation to the member state as regards what should be done in order to improve the economic structures so that the country is better able to provide sustained economic and social welfare for its citizens. In some countries, this means reforming the educational system and improving research and innovation spending. In some other countries, this means reforming the labor market to reduce the duality of the labor market, which is a big problem from the point of view of youth unemployment. And it means also pension reforms in order to ensure the sustainability of public finances. If I would illustrate this to you with a very concrete and relevant example, I would say that Germany and France, the two largest economies of the Eurozone, would do the greatest service for sustainable growth and job creation in the European economy by complementary economic policies, so that Germany would further reinforce domestic demand and boost productive investment, which would help the whole Eurozone growth, while France should further intensify economic reforms to improve its competitiveness, growth and employment. With this combination of economic policies, tailor-made economic policies, the whole Eurozone would be better off and we would have stronger growth and better employment. And that's why we are recommending this to Germany and France.
Now, as a political economist, you are on the cutting edge, or let's say the interface, of politics on the one hand and technocratic solutions. And I'm struck by the use of language and how to do your job, you come up with a language to convince people, whereas the political argument involves different words and different languages and so on. This leads me into this whole issue of European austerity, which is another way of describing fiscal consolidation. And so when you look at what's going on in Europe as a result of the crisis, you know, the unemployment rates in some of the peripheral countries are really quite amazing. In Portugal, youth unemployment is 37%, 26 million people out of work in Europe. So on the one hand, and you know, this is related to youth unemployment and the whole Europe's problem of aging, you know, where people are worried about their future, they're living longer, and so they want to keep their jobs. So it's quite a complex set of problems, you know. In other words, and here we come back to the long-term solution versus the short-term solution, and what the people on this side of the Atlantic who criticize Europe, they see a lot of pain, as does the Europeans who are unemployed and so on. So talk a little about this problem, because in the end, and you've already raised this, that is the legitimacy deficit. That is the democracy deficit. So you've got a really complex problem in the sense that you're moving forward to create a new system which has to be legitimate in the end if it's going to work. But in the short term, in building these institutions, you're creating a lot of dissatisfaction among the voters of Europe, especially in the periphery.
Yes, we are painfully aware of the high level of unemployment in some member states of the European Union, especially those who had the largest imbalances in their economies in the first decade of this century, such as Greece or Spain, and to some extent Portugal. If there were a silver bullet to solve this crisis, to increase growth and reduce unemployment, you can bet that we would have already fired that silver bullet. But there is no one single solution, whether it would be, say, even stronger fiscal discipline or Eurobonds and mutualization of public debt. None of these alone can solve Europe's problems. Instead, we have to work on several fronts in order to create solid foundations for sustainable growth and job creation. And this requires persistence as regards consistent consolidation of public finances. It requires staying the course of economic reforms in the member states, and it requires that we continue to build or rebuild the economic and monetary union. Because while there are some better news from the European economy more recently now in terms of modest growth and bottoming out of unemployment, there is certainly no room for complacency. Instead, we have to stay the course and continue to reform and modernize the European social market economies.
People argue, well, you should be stimulating, not you, but Europe should be stimulating, have a stimulus package to deal with the unemployment. But you really confront, in some ways, a power deficit, don't you, at the center of the European Union. The size of the EU budget is 1% of the European GDP, and whereas in the US it's 25% of the GDP. So your problem seems to be that as you build up the European Union, you are often lacking the power to do things, unless you get, in some cases, the agreement of the powerful actor states, or if you get unanimity, everybody agreeing to it. Talk a little about that, because you seem like you're getting a lot of hellfire in that kind of situation.
In terms of, say, in general terms, as regards economic policy making in Europe compared to the United States, one can say that if you look at the Eurozone, we have 17, soon 18 frigates in a convoy. And to turn that convoy on the sea, it takes quite a lot of internal communication, decision making internally, and then you get the convoy moving to some direction. But each of these parts of the convoy are independent member states. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the federal structure means that the United States is more like an aircraft carrier. Not always easy to turn, as we have seen in the fiscal gridlock, but still, in a way, more effective once it turns. And this makes economic policy making in Europe particularly challenging and sometimes delicate, because you cannot make such rapid moves as in the U.S. In the similar way. On top of this, as you said, the EU budget itself is relatively so small. It's not insignificant. It's a, I would say, a vehicle for investment, innovation, growth. But at the same time, it is not a cyclical policy-making vehicle like the federal budget in the United States. So it means that our short-term devices of enhancing economic growth through fiscal stimulus, if we wanted that, are clearly much more limited than in the United States. Then on top of this, the member states have, as I said previously, have the level of public debt which is already above 90%. Some of them were completely locked out of market, locked out from market funding some years ago: Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and some faced prohibitive borrowing costs like Italy and Spain in the summer and fall of 2011. That meant that kind of an across-the-board fiscal stimulus simply was not possible, because there was nobody funding this fiscal stimulus. Things have to an extent changed since, I would say, the summer of 2012, and mainly for three reasons. First, because of the, thanks to the enhanced credibility of fiscal policy in the euro area member states, we can afford a slower pace of fiscal consolidation now. Second, thanks to the decisive action by the European Central Bank to stabilize financial and bond markets. And third, thanks to the reform and reinforcement of EU economic governance, which now provides a medium-term framework for consistent consolidation of public finances and for the better advancement of economic reforms. These three things have taken the tail risk of the euro breakup away from the table and have facilitated a slower pace of consolidation, have supported the stabilization of the financial markets, and are now paving the way for economic recovery, which of course we have to strengthen, and we cannot rest on our laurels.
Ali, you were a guest on our program 10 years ago, when you were still an important figure in Finnish politics and were only gradually moving toward the European Union. And I went back and watched that interview in preparation for this interview. And one of the things that came out was your strong belief in, I think you called it, principled politics. That is, a politics of principle. But twice in the interview, you quoted Speaker O'Neill from the United States as saying, "All politics is local." So I'm hearing a tension now in your current work, because I'm sure you're somebody who's concerned about equity and who's bearing the burden, you know, of this movement forward in the EU. But on the other hand, you're aware of local politics. How do you think about that in your current job, reconciling those two notions of politics?
As you referred to our interview 10 years ago, I have to thank you for that, because it helped to break the very closed circle of debate in the country I know best, in Finland, which was then not giving room for, say, open and and critical debate on the state of the rule of law as regards certain investigations. I was then, if anything, less a figure in Finnish politics, but rather maybe somebody trying to work in the field of investigative journalism and detective work, which led to results in a sense that my friend was acquitted from any spy allegations, and his reputation was restored. So we avoided a political assassination and destruction of the rule of law in that context. As regards principles in politics, I believe that you have to have clear principles, and you have to follow those principles. At the same time, you also have to have the overall picture in mind, and you have to find realistic solutions that also work in practice. And I believe that this is the eternal challenge of every policymaker or democratically elected politician. You have to reconcile the democratic demands with rational policy making, which means that you also have to communicate your objectives to your fellow citizens. You have to earn their support and base your policies on this democratic support of your citizens.
Well, on that note, Ali, thank you very much for taking the time to come here and really explain to us the complexity of what's going on in Europe.
Thank you very much, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.